After a three-year debate, Congress finally hammers out a compromise on Social Security reform. Benefits will remain the same, but the name Social Security will be changed to "Here's your check, you money-grubbing old crone."
From two corners of the world, it's That's the Thing, the film podcast where twin critics talk about, well, what else? Films. I'm your host, Nick, and your co-host, really, because joining me, as always, is Alex. And I just want to start off again by checking in with you, Alex. How are you doing over there back in Minnesota?
Well, this co-host is doing just fine here in Minnesota. Can't complain. The weather started cooling down, which shows that it's that time again for fall.
That's right, yeah, because, we're recording this on, what day is it today? I can never remember. But
today's the 5th of September. I know, the days sort of meld together, one after another.
Good. I'm glad things are okay. Yeah, things are beginning to cool down over here as well. It's a typical English fall that's approaching. But we are getting a little bit of sunshine, or as David Lynch would say, blue skies and golden sunshine. So, really, it's quite nice. It's a perfect day to, when you should be outside walking and socially distancing from other people in a safe way, it seemed to me like the perfect day to just rather sit inside and have another long distance call with you to talk about yet another movie from 20 years ago, because this is the latest episode in our miniseries about films from the year 2000. And last week we talked about Amores Perros, which is the feature debut of Alejandro González Iñárritu. And we thought that this week we would try actually something a little different. Whereas last week we talked about a filmmaker who emerging onto the international stage. And in essence, we talked a little bit about the career that followed. We wanted to talk about a filmmaker who did make a big splash that same year. And that's actually in that same Cannes Festival, but with a film which tragically ended up being his swan song. And that is Edward Yang's Yi Yi, or A One and a Two, as it's roughly translated into English. And this is actually one of the few movies that, when we were doing this podcast, that we both had seen. But it's been, how long has it been, Alex? Like 8 years ago? Something like that?
I was thinking about that, and I think the first time I saw the film was 9 years ago. And I think it was around that time when you first started really heavily advocating the Criterion Collection movies, and you're saying, oh, let's give this a try, or you gotta see this and that. And Yi Yi happened to be one of those movies, I believe. So yeah, that's when I think that was the last time I saw it, actually, before doing it for this podcast.
Yeah, because, in 2010, about a decade ago, was really when I started getting into the Criterion Collection. And that was a pretty transformative moment for me, because then I realized, oh my god, there's this whole world of cinema that I considered myself a pretty knowledgeable person in terms of my cinephilia. But I really came to realize just how little I actually knew. And and how many filmmakers I really had no idea about. And one of them was, of course, Edward Yang. I had never heard of Edward Yang, but I was really compelled to check out Yi Yi with you, precisely because when it was released, it was immediately acclaimed. It meant a huge international kudos. It won the Best Director Prize at Cannes, as a matter of fact. And like I said, it really was the film that got Edward Yang major notice in the West for the first time in his career. This was his seventh film, so he had made six other films over the course of the last 15, almost 20 years, actually, before he got to Yi Yi. And since then, the film stature has only grown as one of the most beloved of the 21st century. It's often ranked up near the very top of the list of the best films of the first decade of the 2000s. The AV Club actually just did their whole retrospective 2000 list, and they listed Yi Yi as their favorite film of 2000. And it was something that, I gotta be honest, Alex, as I only remembered the film, because again, like you said, it's been 9 years since we watched it. I only remembered the film in sort of broad strokes, so I really wasn't quite sure what to expect coming back to it nearly a decade later. Did you have that same kind of experience?
I did roughly more or less. From what I remember, from the first time seeing it, I remember some images that stuck out to me, and I remember, a certain key plot point that always stuck out to, that always hit an emotional chord with me, but I think we'll get to that later. But yeah, otherwise it was kind of, it was interesting watching it again. It was like watching it with new eyes, watching it anew for me. And just picking up all these details, some which I didn't remember, other things which then clued me in, and it's like then reminded me like, oh, you're right, this happened in this film.
Well, and it's, exactly. I mean, especially because the film is, I mean, to give a little context for listeners who haven't seen the film, the film Yi is essentially a sprawling, well, it's kind of interesting because when I say, I was about to say it's a sprawling ensemble pick, but it's actually really confined in a lot of respects too, because it's specifically about one family and their trials and tribulations over the course of several months. They are a middle-class family living in Taipei at the turn of the millennium. So the film has the four characters, the main characters, I should say, are the father, NJ, who is working in, he's working with his brother-in-law, Adi, in a software company, which is sort of floundering. His wife, Ming Ming, is having something of a emotional and spiritual crisis after her mother, the family matriarch, the grandmother, suffers a stroke at the beginning of the film. There's the daughter Ting Ting, who's about 13, and she's also having something of a little bit of a crisis because she feels that, through no deliberate fault of her own, that she may be in part responsible for the grandmother's stroke, which has caused her to slip into a coma. And then finally we have 8-year-old Yang Yang, who is a very precocious young lad trying to... he's at a point in his life, too, where he's beginning to ask a lot of questions of his father, some of which are basically fundamental. And he's asking some questions which pertain to a sense of human experience, but at the same time are fairly typical of an 8-year-old boy's. Like, how do people see everything around them when they can't see out of the back of their heads? Things like that. So the film is following all four of them, and essentially it's sort of tracking through these different family members a multi-generational tale of what Edward Yang had kind of specifically identified as a very middle-of-the-middle-class family. This family that's doing well in Taipei, but they're on the precipice of the new millennium. And it's, and the one thing that I forgot about this film is just how much of the sort of the coming millennium is sort of hinted at or sort of referenced in, or maybe it's not reference, or it's just, you know, that there's a lot of iconography from specifically 1999. And this movie's not even about 2000 as much as it's about 1999, because you get to see, you know, like at movie theaters where they have posters for Tarzan and Analyze This, or there's...
And Wild Wild West.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, it makes you wonder, like, what were the box office returns for Wild Wild West in Taiwan around that time? But then there's other kind of more culturally specific things. Like, for example, there's a moment when the characters are kind of on the radio. You hear something about references to this French company which built a subway in Taipei, but it was also accused of corporate malfeasance. And that was more explicitly the subject of Yang's previous film to Yi, Mahjong. But I thought what was interesting, you know, coming back to the film again and listening to a little bit of Edward Yang's commentary for the film, how much he actually really intended the film to feel like a time capsule. And I wanted to ask you, Alex, how did you feel coming to it now as a time capsule? Do you think that ends up dating the film? Or how do you think that works or doesn't work in the film's favor?
An excellent question. And actually, that's another recurring motif I feel we've been getting in a lot of the movies we've been covering from 2000, where a lot of them feel like these time capsules. But I don't think it makes the film feel dated, but it reflects a sort of maybe attitude and mindset that I feel pertains not just to Taiwan, but I think around the world. You know, the questions of what will the 21st century and the new millennium hold for us? Where will we be going from here? And whether it's through things like politics or like specifically as the film focuses on, like through entertainment, pop culture, specifically through even like video games, because there's as you mentioned before, how the father, his company is trying to make a deal with this popular Japanese video game developer, Mr. Ota is his name, and how Ota has some would be considered rather radical views on how he feels video games should evolve beyond just, you know, typical fighting action games, and they could be something more. So I think, so it's kind of interesting to think about, when I think about also the year 1999, I think of it as that, a time of excitement, of everyone thinking, what could the possibilities be? You know, where could we go? You know, how far could we go?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's that mixture of kind of possibility and dread, and in the sense that, you know, what if the new millennium holds just more of the same sort of disappointments? And that's definitely, I think, a key theme of Yi as we get to learn more about the family, and especially as you singled out the dad. Actually, I would argue in many respects the two characters in the film who are the most clearly, or maybe not clearly, but most vividly etched out are NJ, the dad, and Ting Ting, the daughter. And that's because the dad, there's, as you were mentioning, he has this subplot where he meets Ota, who I just wanted to also briefly mention is played by Issei Ogata, who a lot of people in the West might recognize from being in Martin Scorsese's Silence. And he's great in that film, and he's great here in Yi Yi as well. And so what you have is NJ really meeting this developer, and he's suddenly confronted with a man who actually is deeply genuine and earnest and passionate about what he's doing in life. And that sort of sends a jolt into NJ's life. I mean, particularly, there's a sequence near the end of the first hour of the film where when the two men finally meet in a restaurant, and it's the first scene in several when they're together where they both speak English. And because English is the common language between Japan and Taiwan. And as they're talking, you along with NJ begin to kind of understand that this Ota is not really, as you said, Alex, he's not your typical video game developer.
If we don't sign, I understand. Risk is high when you do anything for the first time. No problem. Tada, let me know when your company makes any decision.
Okay.
Let's compare. Strange. Why are we afraid of the first time? Every day in life is a first time. Every morning is new. We never live the same day twice. We never afraid of getting up every morning. Why?
So what happens is when he meets this video game developer concurrently, he's also by happenstance in the opening of the film, which takes place at the brother-in-law's wedding, he runs into his first love, Sherry, who moved to the United States. She's taken the surname Breitner, which I think is such a perfect surname for somebody who married a guy from Chicago. and they reconnect and sort of come to terms with the unresolved issues in their love, because as she says almost immediately when she encounters him at first, she says, "Oh, well, I haven't seen you in a while. Here's my business card." And then she almost immediately comes back and angrily accuses him of abandoning her. And we don't quite know what the context of that is until much deeper into the film. But the film is in part about, again, that revisitation of the past as the film kind of goes deeper. And then connecting that with a sense of certain things sort of repeating themselves. Like I was saying earlier now with the daughter of Ting Ting, when she instigates her first love with a young adolescent boy named Fatty, who actually, as she
observes, who's not fat, he has a very slender frame, actually.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a nickname that stuck. And the movie, and it's great, the movie, like, she raises the question and the movie never bothers explaining it. It's just one of those things. And he's dating her good friend Lily, but she sort of ends up falling for him. And, you know, as I'm speaking about all this, as I'm describing the plot of this movie, I begin to kind of realize just how really melodramatic and soapy and dull this could sound on paper. Like, if you gave me sort of the pitch of this movie, I don't know about you, Alex, but I feel like it sounds very banal. And yet, I think in Yang's hands, it becomes this absolutely extraordinary, patient, and really quite generously compassionate portrait of what it's like to be growing older at different stages in life. All of these characters are growing older, and they're all grappling with varying degrees of what could be called growing pains, or in the sense that those growing pains could manifest as adolescence and puberty, or it could manifest as regret, as moving on from the past, with contending with what you value most in life, what you're passionate about. Or even there's this extraordinary moment where the mother talks about this own emptiness that she feels, even as she's trying to talk to her mother, who's in a coma, and this how she's confronted with this own kind of existential or spiritual absence in her life. And I don't know, I don't know how you feel about this, Alex, but for me personally, I think Yang avoids any grandstanding or sentimentalization or really just superficial platitudes in terms of the way that he portrays these characters and them confronting these issues. But do you agree with that, especially now coming back to the film after nearly a decade?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I love how when you describe the premise, you pause to acknowledge that, yeah, it does sound a bit soapy and melodramatic. Like, unless you're a master like Douglas Sirk, I don't know how you can make it an effective melodrama. But Yang doesn't take the Sirkian route, but I think what makes it so strong is that he doesn't try to, like, aggressively go for the heartstrings. He doesn't try to, like, you know, play with underscore or cut to tight close-ups of characters expressing their emotions with tears rolling down their cheeks. In fact, he prefers, you know, he preferably uses a lot of long takes in his film, and which I find very fascinating. I mean, they're components of, along with other things you mentioned too, how they're components of the new Taiwan cinema movement, which sort of came around in, I want to say, the 1980s or so.
Yes, and that's right. I mean, you know, we could talk about all of the new Taiwan cinema, you know, in our own episode. To give kind of a Reader's Digest summary, the new Taiwan cinema did emerge in the early 80s, and it came out of an industry that was really struggling after decades of sort of relying on what it had kind of considered, you know, state-sanctioned propaganda films or sort of carbon copy martial arts films that, well, martial arts films that were carbon copies of Hong Kong and Chinese exports or imports and romance franchise films. And yeah, what happened was the CMPC, which is the Central Motion Picture Corporation, that's the state-run, it was the state-run arm of film for Taiwan, and they were looking for new talent. And so they reached out to this gaggle of filmmakers that had been previously working in television, and they tried to give them more money, invest more in them making films. And some of those directors included Edward Yang, but they also included other filmmakers like Hou Hsiao-hsien, who might be the most famous of the directors, particularly within the West. But then you also had Wu Nianzhen. And Wu Nianzhen actually is, he plays the lead role of NJ in Yi Yi. And in that respect, Yi Yi actually feels a lot like, well, in hindsight particularly, like something of a homecoming for Yang, because you see a lot of actors in this film who he's worked with before, like Elaine Jin, who plays Ming Ming, the mother of the family. She was also the mother in his masterpiece, A Brighter Summer Day. And even the actress who plays Sherry, Su Yun Ko, she was in Taipei Story. And so there's this sense of,
which really was kind of, which was directed by Yang and was produced and starred Hou Hsiao-hsien.
Exactly. So, I mean, really, you have the sense of that there was this very close-knit community of these filmmakers coming out of the 80s. And even the 90s, you know, there was sort of a second wave of filmmakers that included Tsai Ming-liang. But I think, you know, Alex, to respond to your kind of your observation about Yang's cinematic approach towards long takes and wide shots, I mean, I think it's really interesting because he is, like you said, he's emphasizing in a lot of these scenes sort of these master shots, which either can be from a distance or they just sort of track and follow these characters. And I mean, it's interesting, you know, he was explaining why he wanted to do this. He just wanted to, as he said, you know, kind of capture more of the actors' performances in these long takes. And he kind of considered needlessly cutting in a rapid, almost Hollywood-esque fashion to interruptions. And what's interesting is that sort of likening of the cut to a manipulation of the image, to me it seems like it's completely within the wheelhouse of a theorist like André Bazin, who also was arguing when he was formulating sort of his tenets of film theory, of arguing that realism was the full summit of film's potential as a medium, as an artistic expression, that the emphasis should be on long takes, deep focus, and also just an emphasis on time. Because what happens with these long takes and with these wide shots, you have an emphasis on time, on the body of the performers. This all sounds theoretically thought out, but it serves an emotional purpose in this film. And what it does is there are a couple of moments where there are particularly contentious discussions with some of the characters or confrontations. And what Yang does, and what he tried to do, and I think what he succeeds so brilliantly here at, is that he offers his characters a sense of privacy, even though we still hear what they're saying and we get what they're doing, but like, he keeps us at a distance. He keeps us from feeling like we're intruding upon the very raw emotions that are on display here quite frequently. Is that something that, do you agree with that? Or how did you feel about that emotional effect?
Oh yeah, I agree with that, absolutely. Like, you know, and one of the sequences I remembered from the film, from seeing it the first time, was there's a long period where this NJ, the father, he goes to Tokyo and he's reunited with Sherry, and they kind of go for a tour around the city, and they go like they go through the temples and, you know, into the city. They talk about things like the experience of their first date, and there's a period where they just talk about various things, like catching up on what they've been doing since then, and even confronting angrily with each other about their past actions and to why they've been out of touch for 30 years. And you know, even Yang said in the commentary for the film, and I thought of this too as I was watching it, but the way he shoots a majority of that sequence, of that montage of them at the temple, is these distant long shots, so that we feel the emotion that's boiling within these characters, but we're never intruding on them. You know, we're not invading their privacy. It's like he's trying to give these characters a sense of privacy. And I feel like that's a constant throughout the whole movie, where we are watching it as observers, whether we are observing these characters' lives, or even sometimes we're observing alongside some other major characters too about other things that are going on, which I feel ties into another major component too. And I think it sounds theoretical, but there's an emotional core to it too, about like catching authenticity or truth, you know, because as Yang Yang, the son, when he talks to his father, he talks about, yeah, as you said, how adults, if they can see so much, how they can't see the back of their heads. And so this kind of inspires him to take out a camera and start taking pictures of things, including the back of people's heads. And there's a sequence that I think reflects a lot of Yang's views and philosophies about what filmmaking can and cannot do, in which Yang Yang, he goes outside of his apartment, and he's like taking out the camera and taking pictures, and he exits, like he goes down this hall. We don't follow him. Like, the camera's a stationary, like, panning shot. I mean, a lot of the films, actually, I think the whole movie's actually the camera stationary. There's not one handheld shot.
No, not one handheld shot. And that's typical of Yang. Like, that's the other thing that's extraordinary about him, is just the sheer technical discipline he shows throughout all of his work in terms of how he places the camera and where he puts the camera and where he directs our attention.
Yeah, and what's interesting too is that in the sequence, like, you can only get a sense of where Yang Yang is in relation, even though you can't see him, but you see, like, all of a sudden a flash of light, and you hear the sound of the camera clicking. So it's like, okay, he's taking a picture here, or he's taking a picture there. So I think it reflects our limitations of what he imposes upon us as viewers, you know, in being observers, in which he decides not to, like, cut to then him in the other room or something, but he places us, he always keeps us at a distance, spatially, but not emotionally.
Right. Well, and that's the thing that I once I started really getting into more of Edward Yang's movies, which have slowly over the last decade become much more widely available than they were even in 2010. I mean, Yi Yi was still really the only film that was kind of really widely available in the United States. But since then, there's been several major retrospectives of his work, as well as restorations of Taipei Story, of A Brighter Summer Day, of The Terrorizers, which I did talk about briefly a few weeks ago on the podcast. Here's my recommendation of the week. And watching some of these films, yeah, there is that aesthetic consonance in his work of allowing the audience to understand the limitations of where the camera is showing us, but it's not to make us frustrated as much as to reinforce a sense of this understanding that there's a greater world that exists outside of the confines of the frame of the camera. I mean, but it does have, again, like, what's interesting is that even though it's a constant in Yang's work, the way he applies that can often produce very different emotional impacts. So in something like Terrorizers, particularly, you have a great sense of feeling unnerved in the way that Yang withholds narrative information by either obscuring the source of a sound or cutting away to something just when we're about to find out the revelation of something else. Or, you know, in a film like A Brighter Summer Day, he's very economical about what he chooses to show and what emotional gestures characters are making. I mean, it's even an interesting, one interesting motif that he has in his work is that his characters sometimes have a tendency to turn their backs to the camera. And he was saying that there's an interesting, that he believed that you could really learn a lot more about watching a performer from the back than from the front, actually. And that does play into what Yang Yang does in the film, where he's taking the back of people's heads, you know. And maybe that's sort of about what Edward Yang's interested in cinemas, is the ability for cinema to show us things that even we're not fully cognizant of or we're not aware of, but they're constant. They're not even just necessarily simmering underneath the surface, but they're apposite. I just wanted to... Oh, what were you going to say, Alex?
Oh, no, I was just going to say I agree with everything you said. And I think I was thinking about, too, the way he shoots the back of people. And that sometimes gets more, you get more an emotional understanding. Like, I think of this great shot involving NJ taking a phone call. I think you know the scene I'm talking about. And it's a heartbreaking moment. And you can see, like, just the anguish from the back, from the body language.
Well, it's interesting. It's like it's the anguish that we can see, or maybe that we're projecting as well. But I think it's Yang's absolute intelligence as a storyteller that he knows that he doesn't need to mine the audience's emotions for us to feel something. I mean, he employs this strategy to several other scenes as well, where we look through certain events through windows. There are many, many shots in this film where characters are reflected in glass windows. Where we see from afar action that's taking place within the confines of a framed domicile or a living room or bedroom. And yeah, I mean, what Yang is doing, I think, in these scenes, it's not just simply visual showmanship, though. I mean, they are gorgeous images. But what they're doing is, furthermore, I think they're emphasizing a sense of the characters, their emotional growth or lack thereof, in relation to what is ostensibly a changing world, a rapidly changing industrialized global economy. And to me, like, that's what made Edward Yang such a unique filmmaker, is that I think he was quite possibly the premier chronicler of historical change in his native country. I mean, he was born in Shanghai, but his family left when he was only 2 years old in 1949 due to the revolution led by Mao, and he grew up in Taipei. And so he saw firsthand a lot of the brutal effects of martial law that were enacted by the Kuomintang or KMT party of Chiang Kai-shek. But simultaneously, he was also exposed to a lot of Western media. And that is something that transnational element of Taiwan's identity, and particularly Taipei, has informed the character of his filmography, where he is ostensibly observing the historical trajectory of Taipei at certain moments, and that's either in the 1960s at the height of what was called the White Terror, of where people were systematically targeted by the government for fear that they had communist sympathies, or in Terrorizers when he's observing the industrialization of Taiwan and the impact that it has on the growing middle class. And in a lot of senses, Yi Yi feels like the natural progression of what he was chronicling in Taipei Story and the Terrorizers, of where we see that middle class and how they're trying to face this question of, well, now what? As the economy of Taiwan is still doing well, but it's now having to struggle, or rather compete, with the Chinese economy, which is really booming.
Yeah, well, you know, I also think about, you know, when I listened to the audio commentary, Yang pointed out something too, which I found interesting, which he said, during the Tokyo sequence, you have shots of, like, you see these trains that go by. And he mentioned about how whenever he see those trains in Tokyo, it made him feel nostalgic for his childhood days, because it reminded him of when there would be trains in Taipei. But then as he grew up, the trains became removed. And he felt that was like an influence from America.
Because they replaced them with automobiles.
Yeah. And also the trains being there could be said an influence too, because of how the Japanese had occupied Taiwan during the Second World War, only to surrender it by the end. So there is that connection as well. And I think it ties into a major component of the new Taiwan cinema, which is about how, unlike a lot of other film movements, which are more focused on the contemporary and now, a lot of new Taiwan films were considered to mostly focus on the past. Like, a famous example is Hou Hsiao-hsien's A City of Sadness, which was like takes a look back at a real-life massacre known as the February 28th incident. And it's like with some of these movies, the filmmakers wanted to take a look back at these real historical events in their country's history without the government censorship involved or anything. And even though Yi Yi is a contemporary story, I think that looking into the past and thinking about the present and to where you're going to go in the future, it is very constant throughout the entire movie, I feel. Mm-hmm.
I think it's just also worth mentioning, too, that, you know, the reason that A City of Sadness and A Brighter Summer Day were able to, you know, they were coming out and they were really explicitly grappling with the violent legacy of the KMT was because that was right after the end of almost 40 years of martial law. And this sort of, you know, the end of martial law sort of came about when the U.S. began recognizing China as sort of the dominant country of that region, and they sort of began pulling out of Taipei, and you know, a lot of the people who had fled to Taipei, who had caught, I mean, you know, the of the KMT, and you know, a lot of the mainlanders who had come, and they thought that they were going to be able to someday maybe come back to the mainland and retake the mainland, they realized that was never going to happen. And so there's this whole question of, well, now what? And yeah, like you said, like I think a lot of the directors like Edward Yang and like Hou Hsiao-hsien were looking into the past to try and pose that question of, well, now what? But I think I can't say that I'm a huge expert in terms of the output of the other filmmakers from the new Taiwan cinema. I've seen, you know, some by Hou Hsiao-hsien and some by Tsai Ming-liang, but I mean, there's still quite a lot of the new Taiwan cinema that unfortunately remains very, very difficult to watch or to find, really, in any good copy. But that is to say that I think what I've observed from Edward Yang's style of direction is that he really seems to contain this innate understanding of how to map out a story and character actions, but in a way that doesn't feel schematic or overly determined. And so you'll have, again, sort of these long takes, and actually some of these fairly, like, sophisticated camera setups. I mean, there's this great simple shot, you know, that's not very, it doesn't call too much attention to itself, but it's still, like, fairly sophisticated. Near the beginning, when the grandmother is brought to the hospital, and NJ is approached by Adi, who's drunk as a skunk, and he has kind of his drunken entourage, and the camera, like, follows Adi, I believe, and then the camera kind of turns, it pans quite a bit all the way to the window. Again, we see another reflecting shot, and we see the two men talking in the reflection of the window, and as they're talking, simultaneously, you're seeing this drunken entourage just sort of like dancing and talking in the background. I mean, it kind of feels a little bit like a Robert Altman movie briefly in that moment, even though I think that their aesthetic styles are very, very different.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that Yang doesn't have the actors' dialogue overlap each other like Altman typically does. But, you know, I wanted to also hone in on a particular component you keep mentioning, which is the use of reflections and glass windows, which is interesting because, yeah, how there are more buildings and architecture that were using those, that were designing with glass windows, and Yang wanted to seize the opportunity on that because it wasn't scripted that way, but he felt that with the glass windows, he could find intriguing ways to give more dimension and depth to his shots. And I think it also ties into that the question of how much truth can be conveyed, of like how much we can see as an audience, and how, as you point out, how he indicates many times to the audience how there's a world that's beyond what we are, that of the main narrative of what we are witnessing. Like, I think of, for instance, a scene when Ming Ming is, after she is tearfully telling her husband about how, like you said, she's having the spiritual crisis, from her communications, attempt at communications with her mother. And then you cut to like the outside where you see like their apartment neighbors, like Lily's mom, who's a divorced mom, and she has like a new boyfriend every week or so. And they're getting into like a domestic tiff or something, that it becomes a very heated argument, and there's like crashes and noises. And then it cuts to the window of the main family where Ming Ming is still crying. So we hear the sounds of both the crying and the domestic abuse going on. And in this shot with the main family, the window, NJ turns off the lights. So we get a reflection of the traffic, of the car lights on, like going down the roads. And what I think he's trying to capture in that shot, Yang, with the audio and the visuals, is trying to get to give us this understanding that all this is going on right now. I mean, these are just two components, but like imagine all the different stories or potential dramas or lack of that are occurring from down below in the streets.
Exactly. No, I think you've hit the nail on the head. And in that way, the film is yet again another in this sort of series of what can be considered network narratives or hyperlink cinema. I mean, it's not in as showy a way as something like Traffic or Amoros Perros, where we see these discrete characters and they all intersect at one common point. But I mean, there is that, as you said, that sense of totality that Yang's trying to produce. And I do think that it is something like, you know, what Robert Altman was trying to produce in terms of his big ensemble films like Nashville, or even something like McCabe and Mrs. Miller, the way that he portrays community. And Yang, of course, you know, at this point, he was a master of that. You know, with A Brighter Summer Day, it's 4 hours long, but you don't feel like a single minute of that movie is extraneous because it's dedicated to really giving you a sense of the totality of this world that he's showing us on screen and the world that exists beyond the screen.
Well, I think that attitude of like of indicating that there's a world beyond what's there on the frame too, or there's stories that are beyond what we've seen before and afterwards, it reminds me too of the works of Abbas Kiarostami and Michael Haneke, to be perfectly honest.
I mean, I can see that. I mean, well, and especially with both of those filmmakers as well, like the way that they, you know, they could be considered part of slow cinema where they have long shots of observing characters performing these quotidian acts. And I do think that Yang's entry in slow cinema, in a lot of respects, it serves as a counterpoint to the rapid industrialization and the globalization that's unfurling, and the way that sort of compartmentalizes our way of thinking and of seeing the world. I think he's actually, with all of his films, or with the films of his that I've seen, and this, particularly with Yi as his final film, I think he adopts the use of slow cinema to serve as this rebuke of this almost ADHD-littered way of filmmaking, of not being able to process the world as it is. And here's the thing, though. Like, this all sounds, again, like somebody would think, well, that sounds all well and good, but, like, you know, just because he's an interesting director in terms of the way that he paces his sequences, that doesn't mean, like, you know, the story's great. But here's the thing. I think Yang was a genius when it came to structuring his scripts, and I think the script of Yi Yi is just so tightly constructed. And even like in terms of the opening shot and the last shot, they rhyme each other almost perfectly, but you never, again, you don't get the sense that it's overly determined. I think what's great about it is that Yang lets us feel this sense of discovery of when the plot takes certain developments, or when we kind of realize nearly the symmetrical structure of his epic. And then you kind of realize, like, certain things that you kind of take for granted as just, oh, that's sort of a minor detail, it comes back into play later on. Like the use of video games and the kind of the video game iconography. It comes back near the end in a way I won't quite spoil, but in a way that's a pretty pointed and satirical and frankly disquieting way.
I agree with you completely. I think his script structure is excellent because even though it's a 3-hour film, it's very difficult for me to imagine. I cannot, like, imagine taking... There's a single scene or moment in this movie that I ever thought to myself, well, this is unnecessary. They could cut this out. It's long, but I feel like every scene is essential, and it's tightly packed. It's tightly edited, and it shows what it needs to show, and it goes on for as long as it needs to for the emotional effect it desires. And even the way that scenes sort of connect to each other through maybe sound bridges or visual contrasts, I think, is also very strong. And how you say, yeah, like, it's apparent, but he doesn't make it, like, overtly obvious. Like, there's a scene where even Yang Yang, there's a scene where he's hiding in an auditorium and they're watching this film. And I like the scene for a few different reasons. But, like, then there's this older girl who comes in who he's had been in contact with before. She's kind of referred to by other boys as the concubine, you know, and derogatory terms like that. But then it's the first scene where he kind of has a little... I think it's implied that he is a little physically attracted to her, at least. Or he's having the first stages of that budding attraction for someone of the opposite sex, especially for a boy his age. And while this is going, like, there's a shot that I think really sticks out where we see the girl and she's, like, standing up, and behind her is the screen is playing this educational film, which is talking about the weather. And it talks about the narrator talking about how lightning and thunder come together, these two opposing forces, and they essentially create life. And it works because of how it cuts to Ting Ting outside in an actual rainstorm. And I think it works on that regard, but also because of how people... You know, usually when you describe about love or attraction, you say it's like getting hit with a bolt of thunder. Like, honestly, when watching that scene, I was thinking of a moment from The Godfather when Michael Corleone first meets Apollonia while he's in exile in Italy. And his friends, noticing the look he has on his face, are like, uh-oh, looks like he got hit by the thunderbolt.
Yeah, but I mean, what's also brilliant about that, too, is that in the context of that scene with Ting Ting, in that scene, then she... really is beginning to sort of instigate more of her own romantic relationship with Fatty. So again, like, in terms of the story and moving the story along, Yang is very mindful about how he moves the plot along, but in a way that, as you said, does not feel overt. And I think it's that careful consideration for all aspects of the film that just makes Yi Yi a really extraordinary film. I mean, right down to the period detail, even to something like in Yang Yang's room, of something like the Batman and Robin poster that's hanging on his wall, you know, from the animated series, to like even little Astro Boy figurines on his shelf, which actually seems to be more of a personal nod from Yang himself, because he was a huge fan of manga. He loved Osamu Tezuka and he loved Astro Boy growing up. And again, like, I think what makes Yi such a an emotionally resonant and rich film is the compassion that he has for every character in the film, and how in many respects all of them contain some sort of component of either him or a shared experience with others in his life. And I think, and you never get the sense that you're watching somebody who feels like they're considering their subjects in an anthropological or even sociological lens. I mean Yang is intelligent enough to take all of those into consideration, but he never ever loses sight of the tentative emotions of the human heart. I mean, which sounds, again, corny, but in Yang's hands, it really generates something special. And again, I think it's, you know, I think it's wonderful that he gave us 7 films, but it's such a loss to world cinema that just when he was really beginning to find the international acclaim that he so deserved in his career, then he ended up passing away 7 years after Yi Yi came out.
He died from colon cancer, which I know has been getting a lot of headlines lately because of the unexpected passing of Chadwick Boseman last week. But yeah, it was extremely sad because he had so much to offer. I know he had other scripts and projects he was developing. He had a screenplay actually about, I think he pitched as just a boy in a cell phone, I'd love to see other Yang's films, because unlike you, Yi Yi's the only one I've seen, which I imagine might be the case for many people, because like you said, that's the most widely available in the United States. But, I also just find it interesting, his ideas that he had. He even wanted to develop an animated film with Jackie Chan, which you showed me an animation test to, which I thought was incredible. And I don't know if it would have changed the face of animation, but I think it would have been one of those films that would excite people to see, like, what you can do with animation, and to get that reminder or understanding from a director who's typically known for his live-action forays.
Exactly. But again, I think Yang's appreciation and really just outright love of the possibility of visual storytelling would have made it a really interesting and captivating, project. But I mean, we can only speculate. But again, I think as tragic as his passing, because again, he was only 59 when he passed, so he was still a young man in a lot of ways when he passed. But I still think the work that he left us is just simply extraordinary. And I do think Yi Yi is, I mean, I think we've both kind of made it apparent now. But I mean, if it wasn't apparent now, it is now that it really deserves wholeheartedly its reputation as one of the great films of the last 20 years. I mean, of all of the films that we've revisited so far in this podcast, Alex, like, this is far and away, I think, the best one that we've revisited. It's the one I've been most glad to revisit, and the one that I feel like I'm only going to just continue finding more and more resonance the older I get.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%, and watching Yi Yi again, I was very happy to see it. And it's like, I love those kinds of movies where you can revisit again and again, and there might be a detail or a moment that you overlook, or like you said, or you take for granted, but then you rewatch it and it gains new meaning for you, or like even what a character says. And I think what makes it stand so strongly and what makes Yi Yi such a brilliant film is how it talks about so much, but it never overwhelms the story itself. It's all economic, as you put it. And I think that, and this may sound corny, but I think it's true, where the level of intelligence it conveys is only matched by its heart.
And I think Edward Yang said something, I mean, he was referencing specifically about the trend of, newborns being filmed by their parents, but I think it's completely apt for this film as well, and his cinema in general. But he likened that practice to one of the pleasures of being able to, quote, record the way a life is progressing in time. And through its several different characters, what Yi Yi ultimately is, it's a record of the way life progresses through time. So it's a masterpiece. If you haven't seen it, we cannot recommend it highly enough.
And, I just want to take a quote from it, too. Like, you were talking about just the pleasure of recording this, of recording that, capturing the moment of your newborn child. But it reminds me of an exchange between two characters at the end of the film, which I think is very pointed, but also it's powerful, where, one character says to another, if you don't love what you're doing, then why are you doing it?
Or specifically, it's the one character says, I'm very unhappy. And another character says, well, if you don't love what you do, how could you be happy?
So, yeah, I guess now comes the point where we check in to see if there are other good movies we've seen. So I want to start with you. Have you been able to see any good movies lately, Nick?
Excellent question, Alex. I must confess, again, I haven't been watching as many movies as I would like, if only because, as always, that pesky dissertation deadline is impending, and I've been writing and writing and writing, and, either, like, revisiting clips of films that are related to that dissertation or my grad project. But I will say that I did have the good fortune of earlier this week seeing some films, well, earlier this week and a little bit into the last week, seeing some films that were screened at the at this year's edition of Il Cinema Ritrovato over in Bologna. I mean, that is to say, I didn't fly all the way out to Bologna and sit down with other people. I watched it, thankfully, safe and sound in the comfort of my own home through their digital streaming platform, which was nice. I felt completely relaxed, and I got to see some really nice restorations of some films that I had heard about and several that I didn't. And one of them that I didn't hear about and that I know has been very, very difficult to watch for a long, long time. It's an Iranian film from 1976. It's called The Chess Game of the Wind. Now, have you ever heard of this film, Alex?
No, I hate to say, but I have not had the pleasure of hearing it before.
Well, you know, I mean, don't be too surprised, because again, like, this is a film that I hadn't heard about until I signed up for this festival, and or I got, you know, I decided to look through their program, and I saw that, oh, they're screening a old Iranian film, and I was saying to myself, I've never heard of this film, and the reason why you've probably never heard of it is because it was like a lot of the new Taiwan cinema we were talking about earlier, including some of Edward Yang's films pre-Yi. It was damned difficult to find this movie for decades. It's from 1976, and it was only screened once at the Tehran International Film Festival. And then 1979, it was subsequently banned, and the negative was thought long lost. So the only way to watch it was kind of these bootleg or VHS rips of really low quality. And then only a few years recently, until like fairly recently, the director of the film, Mohammad Reza Aslani, he found the, I mean, this is true. He found the film. I don't know if it was him or somebody else that he knew, but somebody found the negative of this film, sold it at a flea market. You know, just one of those little trinkets that you sell. And it's like, it reminded me of when they found the complete print of Dreyer's Joan of Arc in the closet of the insane asylum. You know, like, it's just one of those very happy, happy accidents that saves a film from complete oblivion. And I mean, really, I think it's a real gift that this film has been saved, because it is, especially in its restored version, a sumptuous feast. The film is essentially, to kind of give you a vague idea of what it is, it's essentially about this family during the Qajar dynasty, which is kind of late 19th, early 20th century. And what the film is about, it's about this matriarch of a house who has just passed away. And now the lady of the house, who's not really a young lady, she's something of a invalid. She's confined to a wheelchair that's rolled around by her trusty maid, who actually is played by, in her very first film role, a very young Shoria Agdashlu. And she's, the lady of this house is sort of contending or fighting with her stepfather for control of this house. And the film has been likened before to the work of Luchino Visconti. And watching the film, I definitely can see that. Like, it's because, especially in its restored form, it's a visual feast, because you see these shots of often low-lit, intimate little ornate rooms, sometimes these close-ups of finery, of privilege and of power, including gold and jewelry, and it's all captured by the DP Husheng Baharlu to this really stirring and evocative effect. But I think what makes the film so interesting is not that it's just simply a Luchino Visconti ripoff. Rather, without giving too much away, it really begins to, you realize, delve into this realm of the Gothic. And it actually, in terms of its story, it resembles a lot more the film, the Clouseau film, Diabolique. For anybody who's seen Diabolique, you might have an idea of what I'm talking about in terms of where The Chess Game of the Wind goes. And that is mirrored in the film's increasingly claustrophobic and even discordant unease that it generates in what amounts to this very strange, almost surreal climax that seems like it's been fetched out of a nightmare. And the thing is, the film is constantly engaged with questions of power, particularly female power within a patriarchal construct, reclaiming something outside of patriarchal control. And the film affords a lot of screen time, not just to the two main women that I talked about, but all of these scenes of a lot of women servants sort of obliquely commenting on information that we haven't seen in the plot or backstory, or talking about their own problems or their own daily travails. But in that sense, the film is completely sympathetic to what can be considered something of a feminist agenda. And so it's no wonder that the film has been banned by the Islamic Republic, especially with some of the gothic turns it takes in the story. I'm very, very excited. I think the film is, for all of our listeners in New York City, or any of the listeners in New York City, the Film Society Lincoln Center will be screening it later this month. I believe it's the 23rd or the 24th. I would just double check with their website. I'm sure we'll be able to feature a link in the main page of this article. But in any case, if you have the chance to see this film, I'm sure it'll be making some of the rounds in terms of digital screeners. And of course, a home video release by Criterion, because the Film Foundation restored it. But if you can see it, it's absolutely worth checking out. It's a lost treasure of the Iranian New Wave that has finally been rediscovered, and thank goodness for that.
I mean, yeah, it sounds like quite an incredible film, and I can't wait to see it when it comes around here. Sadly, I'm not in New York, so if you're willing to go to the Lincoln Film Center, and if it's safe to go out there, you know, then I'm very happy for you, and that sounds like it's the world's good fortune that this movie was found.
Exactly. Well, it's like, yeah, again, like I said, like it always does my heart good to know when we have movies like that, or like Wake and Fright, that are just sort of almost literally snapped from the jaws of oblivion. And it helps, again, provide another valuable wrinkle in what has been misconstrued as something of a monolithic or homogenous view of film history, and particularly of Iranian cinema. And I think this film definitely will only add to the complex and rich narrative that the history of Iranian cinema has provided, beyond the entry of Panahi and Kiarostami and Mehrzad Majidi and a lot of the filmmakers who came out of the 80s and 90s. But yeah, great film. Definitely check it out. But what about you, dear brother? What cinematic treasures have you unveiled this past week?
Yeah, I've seen a few movies, some that were great, some okay, but there's one I want to single out, and I had previously mentioned another film from this director, but I had gotten the chance to see Andrei Tarkovsky's final film, The Sacrifice, which was released in 1986, I want to say 7 months before his death.
Alex, you watched two Tarkovsky movies in 2 weeks?
I know. It wasn't easy, but I managed to get through it.
Oh, man. I mean, that's got to take an emotion. You got to go out. If you can go out in your backyard, just, like, sit in the sunshine for a minute. Because, I mean, we knew that nostalgia is, you know, kind of dark, but The Sacrifice is...
Sacrifice is even darker, I do feel. There's something quite macabre about the whole thing, considering that it's his final film. Because for those of you who don't know it, I mean, I can imagine a lot of cinephiles are familiar with this movie, but it's about essentially this pretty well-off Swedish family. They live in this, and they're kind of in this cottage out in the countryside, and they're celebrating the patriarch's birthday. He's played by
Erland Josephson. Sorry, yeah, of course, Erland Josephson, that great Swedish actor from Ingmar Bergman's Stock Company.
And he's not the only Bergman player or, you know, person who has collaborated with Bergman who's worked on this film. I mean, we also have the great Sven Nykvist giving the haunting, unforgettable cinematography of this film. And anyways, in the story, like, they're celebrating his birthday, Alexander's birthday, but then there's a news report that breaks out that World War III is essentially upon them. And so there's this very intense and cataclysmic feeling of doom and despair, and Alexander is feeling very desperate, and he wants to figure out what he can do to save humanity. And so he decides, And it's a little convoluted. It's a little difficult to explain how. Maybe it's just kind of that dream logic too, which is so pertinent to Tarkovsky. But then a friend of his tells him, you know, there's this woman who lives not too far away from here by this church. She's actually a witch. You can go to her and ask for her help to help, like, to stop World War III. So he decides to go there. But in the process, he makes a deal where he, of course, he gives up something. He pays the ultimate sacrifice, in which involves with, once again, just like nostalgia, an unforgettable climax, though a very different kind, different from the one I had mentioned previously. But
right, but it is another long shot that, yeah, when you watch it, you simply kind of marvel at it, and the stomach turns to think about the logistical nightmare.
Well, you know, actually, I watched
pulling off that shot.
I watched a documentary after this called directed by Andrei Tarkovsky, which was directed by the film's The Sacrifices editor, and Mikhail Lesielowski. And
bless you.
And actually, they had shot this climax once before, but something went wrong, and it wasn't quite able to work. So then, and to give you an idea, without going too much away, involves a famous something burning down. And a famous burning, but something they didn't quite catch the flames everywhere. So then they had to like reset. They had to shoot the whole thing all over again and like reset up the whole set.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing that, yeah, I can see it being a logistical nightmare, but it's one of those films too. Like even yeah, it is kind of dark and I would be lying if I said watching the movie, I wasn't thinking about that kind of, you know, having those kinds of similar gloomy feelings too, similar to what some of the characters experience watching, you know, during this film, you know, and like there's even a great sequence where when the news breaks out about World War III, like there's the daughter in the family, she essentially like has this complete nervous breakdown. She sobs uncontrollably and she has to be sedated, and it's this long, anguishing kind of sequence, but you can't take your eyes off of it. You can't look away.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just all gloom and despair. But how again it ties into some of the themes which were also apparent in Nostalgia, and they seem to be of interest to Tarkovsky, at least late in his life, where he talks about like humanity and faith. And about you know, if humanity is worth saving, you know, to save mankind and to save the world, and the extremes one would take to do that. Even though it seems like the filmmaking with it, like, and the colors are very desaturated in it, like they're almost, it's all like they're so muted that it could be almost black and white. But and a lot of people have compared it to Bergman, feeling like it's Tarkovsky's tribute to Bergman, which is interesting because I think Bergman himself, I believe he actually called Tarkovsky the greatest filmmaker working at that time. So
I know that they both had a tremendous respect for each other.
So yeah, there are a lot of themes, and of course that you can make in comparing it with Bergman, and also with the players Josephson and Nyqvist, as I mentioned, being involved with this project. But I still think it also stands on its own as a part of Tarkovsky's body of work, and it's very long, it's slow, it's 2.5 hours long, and so if you start getting sleepy while watching it because it goes at a very languid pace, and if you get tired or sleepy, I don't blame you for it. But if you're willing to stick it through, I think again, like Nostalgia, I think it's a rewarding experience, and it's unforgettable.
And it's interesting, you know, comparing both of those films, because again, both Nostalgia and The Sacrifice were the two movies that Tarkovsky made. As I was mentioning before last week, these are the two movies that he made outside of the Soviet Union, outside of the USSR. And
he also had made a documentary outside of the USSR called Voyage of Time.
Sure. Oh, sure, yeah. But I mean, in terms of his fiction films, what's interesting is that's connected with these two is that it is very much about the sense of something coming to an end, and this real theological or spiritual inquiry into the question of, well, when something comes to an end, where can we generate a sense of renewal, or what can grow out of the end of something? And Tarkovsky doesn't really give us a clear answer for that, but it's not that he's trying to kind of shirk us or ignore the issue or avoid actually taking responsibility for the question. He's trying to kind of I think, again, what he is, like you were saying, what he's focusing more on more is that whatever it takes, the process requires everything that we have within ourselves as a species. And that sometimes isn't pretty, and it can be devastating, but it also can, I think, in Tarkovsky's view, produce something rapturous and even divine in terms of us working towards the salvation of ourselves, of the world we live in, of anything, of everything, really. So it's not the first Tarkovsky I would recommend people enter into, but it's a Tarkovsky nevertheless. And like you were saying, Alex, some of the imagery that he produces in this film stands with some of the most dreamlike and inimitable of his entire career.
Yeah, though it's interesting because it's very haunting, dreamlike, almost nightmarish at points. But it's, like I said, again, and yeah, I agree with you where I would probably recommend some other films of his before getting to this one. But even if you're a Tarkovsky fan, of course you're going to love it. But like if you see some of his stuff and like it and you want to give this a try, I think it's worth it. And I think it's a strong final chapter to what was also a career that was tragically cut short.
And from a filmmaker who was one of the great figures in world cinema as well. I mean, at least it's tragic that of Tarkovsky's passing, but I mean, the one thing that is, I mean, somewhat of a relief is that during his lifetime, he saw more and more of those accolades, but then Edward Yang maybe did. But you know what, regardless, you know, Andrei Tarkovsky and Edward Yang, both extremely different filmmakers, but with their last films only reaffirmed just the extraordinary depth of talent and perspicacity into the human struggle that they both possessed as artists. I would say if you're looking for a last film that is a little less formidable, definitely go with Yi before you watch. You know, just double bill it. Just watch Yi first, and then you're like, oh, that was nice. Like, that was sad, but, you know, I really want something that's a little not as light in that way. And then, you know, just go for The Sacrifice after that. You know, it's a great double bill. It's like 6 hours, but it's worth it.
It sounds like Lars von Trier's recommendation, like, hey, Lars, have you got something? This is a little sad. Have you got something better? Well, if you mean sadder, yeah, I've got something for you.
Well, I mean, now that would have, you know, it is funny you mentioned Lars von Trier since, you know, he'd had a movie that same year in Cannes that won the top prize. But
there were some great movies that screen at Cannes, some which we may get around to, some which we may
exactly
not.
I'll just simply say that, you know, we may be getting onto those in the next time, but for now I'll just simply say, if you have any recommendations of things that you've seen lately, we're always keeping an ear out for what to catch. Drop us a comment, send us a message. If you have any thoughts about Edward Yang and his cinema, let us know what you think. And I mean, you can even, if you've never seen anything, or if you've seen all of his films and you consider Yi his best, or A Brighter Summer Day his best, or even if you might be one of the controversial few that think Mahjong is the unappreciated masterpiece, you know, there are people out there who love it. I frankly haven't seen it yet, but I know it's divisive. But you know, if you've got thoughts about Edward Yang or the new Taiwan cinema, feel free to join in the conversation, because that's what we're hoping to generate through these episodes. And as always, it's a joy to be in a conversation with you, Alex, about great movies. And again, Yi is certainly one of the great movies of our lifetime. So thank you, Alex. Thank you, listeners, for joining us on this little trip through cinema history. As always, be well, stay safe out there, and continue watching great movies.
And thank you, Nick, for also bringing your thoughts into this and for discussing about this wonderful feature. Take care, everyone. We're all in this together.